uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network. Right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being here with us tonight for a Friday night, late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. We're going to be getting into various news and information here tonight, as well as some emails, and also our continued series of reading from Zach Ryan Sitchin's The End of Days. So thanks for being here with us again tonight. It is Friday, February the 3rd, into Saturday, February the 4th, 2012. My name is Josh Reeves. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's TheGlobalReality.com. And didn't have any live shows the past couple of days. There wasn't a lot of material. So you have tech issues, weird stuff going on with our stream box over here. I'm starting to get it worked out. I was working on it tonight. That's why we were starting later tonight. Because for a while now we've had problems with skipping in the music, skipping in the tracks and stuff, and it seems to be internet related. I mean, I've noticed that anytime if I refresh a page on another computer, the stream will skip, and it didn't used to do that. So that seems kind of odd to me. So I'm working through it. I don't know. It seems to be better now than it was earlier tonight. So we'll go with it and we'll see what happens there. You know, I this computer that I got for the network is not very old, but it was a refurbished one. So that very well could be the case. I don't know. It seemed because, like I said, everything on this thing is shut down. There's nothing. There is very little. Only what the operating system needs to run in the background, running on this thing, and it's like a 3 gig dual core with 6 gigs of RAM. So it's got plenty of power. Sam Broadcaster doesn't take that much to push. So. It's definitely not related to that, but yeah, I mean, it seems to be running really good now. But anyway, there was like a paging file thing, an issue going on. It seemed like there wasn't enough memory allocated to the paging RAM or something. So I upped that a little bit. I could up it a little more, and I probably will do that later because it seems like, well, you know, I mean, I come from an old tech phone computer tech background, so it always sticks with you. You go through and try everything and see if anything changes. And then, whatever the last thing was that you did, if it changed, then that was obviously your solution. So, it seems to have run smoother since then. It only thing is it reset. It did a clean sweep of all of my settings for Sam Broadcaster, which really fucking sucks. You know, because you tweak this thing, you tweak it, and you get it sounding good, you get it sound the way you want to, and then it wipes you back to fucking zero. You're like, oh. So, if it sounds different, if the audio sounds different or not as good, bear with me. I'll try to tweak it more and get it sounding crisper and better and cleaner and all that good stuff. So, thanks for being with us. Our first broadcast of February of 2012. And we've got quite a few interesting things to talk about here tonight with you on the show. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. There you can find my newest documentary film, The Secret Volume 2. And that is out right now. And it's not up for free to watch yet. So the only way you can see that movie is by buying a DVD or a Blu-ray right now. And you can go there and get copies of those. And please go there and get copies of those, because once these are gone, this is it. They're going to be gone. All these are pretty much going to be limited edition. You know, we're limited to the copies that we have on hand right now of the DVDs and Blu-rays. That's going to be it. Once those are gone, that's gone. I'm not going to be ordering anymore. Matter of fact, it's going to be my last film. I'm not going to be making documentary films anymore. Because I don't have a budget. I don't have a budget to do it. I need a budget to make this next film, and it's, I don't have it. I had a $1,500 preliminary budget set, for last month, so I could begin some of the shooting phases over the next few weeks, but we're off that schedule now. So, without funding to do it, there's no way I can do it. I can't do this like I did last time and string along for 2 years and, you know, get a little money here and a little money there and get it done. It just won't work that way this time. I've got to have a little cash up front for each phase of this. And without that, I can't do it. So, I'll continue to make little, you know, like I did the reality of illusion things. I'll continue to do those type of things and online stuff. But big film projects like The Seeger Right and then the next film with the Rock Wall and stuff, that's over with. Cause I just, you know, I put all this money into making these things and make not a zip zero back to make the next one. And, that's just a bad business model. It's a bad model to try and do it. You know, if somebody came to me and said, you know, here's a budget, here's $5,000 or whatever, you know, okay, right, fine. I would make a film, but, you know, trying to nickel and dime my way to do this, it just doesn't work anymore and it's not going to work. So. That's all there is to it. So you got that out of the way. So please get those films, because I'm going to be bowing out of filmmaking, it looks like, at this point, because of, we squeaked by and got the bills paid last month. Thanks to everybody who helped us out. But, that was it. And that is it. You know, that's all we're left with. We're not left with much after that. So. There you go. Let's see what we have here. We have a few emails tonight. Let me see what we have. Oh, where'd it go? No, that's not it. That's one I already read. Hey, when do they get? So I get a lot of emails in here, so I have to kind of. I don't delete any of them because I want, you know, I love the guy stuff you guys send me. So, this is from Dan. Dan says, "Hi, Josh. I love your show and the way you see through the shit. I have an interest in the ancient history stuff and have enjoyed your readings. Very interesting and funny as fuck. You might find this interesting. About a year or so ago, I found this site, the chronicleprojectmirror.org. They are a group of Jewish Canadians who get together to study and read their Bible. One of them noticed some similarities with the Hebrew words and their meanings, which has led them to possibly deciphering the true ancient Hebrew language. I was wondering why these Jewish scholars had all these big-ass reference books to read their own language. Now I know why. They don't know what the fuck they're reading. Here's the first page from their research note. In the beginning, the Hebrew language was originally believed to have been a combination of other older languages, which evolved into the Hebrew dialect. Yeah, Semitic and... Canaanite, some of the, and even, you know, the older Middle Eastern languages, Akkadian. The breakthrough in our understanding began with the concept that rather than an evolved language, it might be exactly as it described itself, the language of God. It was with this premise in mind that the Chronicle research team approached the language for several reasons. Number one, if Hebrew was a mix of older languages around it, then the first five books of Moses, the Torah, as most believe, are a mere compilation of older legends collected, handed down through the generations. Well, I can stop them right there. Absolutely, that's the case. Somebody needs to get a hold of these Jewish Canadians and tell them that, you know, us bumpkins down here in Texas are already way ahead of them on this. absolutely. I mean, good God, man. Yeah, that's common knowledge. Yeah, the Bible, the Torah, all that stuff went back to much older civilizations in ancient Sumeria. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But it's fantastic that, you know, there are people in, you know, from all walks of life all over the place are starting to figure this out. But, you know, I just have to say to them, thank you for coming to dinner finally. Thank you for joining us. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, really, I could stop you right there, but I'll continue to read this. It says, if so, then as a holy writing, they had no more validity than any other legend. Why? Because they contradict the story of their own creation, which states that they were given to us by God at Mount Horeb. Number two, if Hebrew was as described in the opening statement given of God, then the rules from other man-made languages used to interpret the Hebrew language were not applicable. Their use would cause widespread error in the translation. And so the question was posed, if this truly is the language of higher beings given to man, should it not show evidence of this? With this in mind, the team began searching for unified rules, set patterns that would occur in such a language. But the first breakthrough came from Kim examining the Hebrew word to tear up, number 5420 in Strong's dictionary. She noticed that the following words in the list held the same concept of to tear, but the direction changed when the third letter changed. So by this, it became apparent that the first two letters carried the main concept of the idea, and the next letter gave the description to the concept as follows: tear up, tear out, tear down, tear off, tear asunder, tear away. The team then began to check other words and found this common pattern. With this in mind, a two-word list of what the team believed were the root words was assembled to see if a common pattern for the added letters could be found. After the 18th month and multiple attempts at a successful list of the 22 letters and their effect on the root words were assembled. It was at this time considered that the two-letter root words were not words at all, but that each letter or glyph shape was its own concept. This was the quantum leap that we had been looking for. Each letter of the Hebrew language was not a letter after all, but rather a symbol for a word, just as the Egyptians have with hieroglyphs, but with a stunning difference. The complete language was formed using only 22 glyphs, which by simple combination would create any idea that one wished to convey. Right, any idea that one, yes. In the beginning there was a word, yeah, that's Kabbalism. That's Kabbalistic magic. That's exactly what that is. That's what that language is. It's much older than Earth. And it's the ability to be able to use phrases in such a way that you can actually manifest material being, worlds, universes, galaxy, planets into being using this language. That's why, you know, in the beginning there was the word, the spoken word. That's what that was. It was using that word and using that language in that way to call into material existence things using the voice in these phrases. And guess what? We all have the power to do that, but they're not going to let us know how to do it. Starting to see where this whole enslavement system of the priest class and religion really comes from. Look into Manly P. Hall, Secret Teachings of All Ages, the Kabbalistic Origins of Humanity. Because that really says it all. The complete language was formed using only 22 glyphs, which by simple combination could create any idea that one wished to convey. Interestingly, the first compilation of the work was completed on the first day of Purim in 2009. With a list of the 22 glyphs, the team was now able to approach the book of Genesis to read what was actually there for the first time in over 1,500 years. And the first word, which was as long as anyone can remember, has read in the beginning, became to amid, to perceive, to project, to manifest, to make visible, to envision, and then to make it visible, to continue. Or in simple English, the action of taking something from the mind and writing it down so that it might continue. So the book of Genesis begins with this word, to chronicle. It'll be worth reading their translations. Also, if you haven't looked into Klaus Donner, he has a slideshow, some amazing artifacts that may have something to do with the builders of the rock wall. These artifacts are made with impossible materials and have an unknown language on them. Also, when they light them with a black light, part of the artifacts glow, revealing symbols. I think that a lot of them were found in the Americas. Wow. Anyway, respect to you, subscribed, Dan. Well, thanks, Dan. That's a fantastic email. Thanks for the information there. But yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, those are all great points of things that, you know, a lot of us who have been researching this stuff for years have known. And now it seems that people in the scientific community and stuff are starting to research these things. And I mean, I really think that they're starting to allow a lot more of this stuff to come out and a lot more to be talked about, because they are talking a bit about it on stuff like ancient aliens and stuff like that. So I really think they're allowing a lot of this stuff to come out right now. That's one of the reasons why I've been covering it, because I kind of wanted to get a jump on these guys and at least get some radio shows and some stuff on the record from the perspective of not buying what the mainstream is selling us. And I think that, at least from what I've seen, there aren't a lot of other shows out there that are doing that. So I think that's why it has been important for me to do The Lost Book of Enki and The Emerald Tablets of Thoth. And now we're doing Sitchin's End of Days. That's why I think it's been so important for me to do that, is because I think all this stuff's coming. I think that they're going to allow a lot of this stuff to come out, or, you know, maybe they know something, maybe they don't know. Maybe the Anunnaki are going to return. I don't know. You know, maybe that's what they're prepping us for. I mean, that's what all this combination of this stuff has been, while they've been allowing this stuff to come out. But I think more appropriately, it does set up the ability for them to bring about one world religion with this information. So that's kind of the double-edged sword of talking about this stuff. But again, I think it's important to at least have, you know, get some other sides of the story on the record to this, so that people out there have the tools in the future to be able to discern for themselves what's real and what isn't. Because as we move forward into time, folks, the powers that be are going to continue to make it difficult for us to realize what is real and what isn't. They did a fantastic job of doing that on 9/11. And thankfully, a lot of us saw it for what it was later. Few of us saw it for what it was at the time, including myself, but it wasn't even polite to even talk about it. You know, at the time, people were, you know, really, you know, it was just such a horrible thing. People just didn't even want to hear any other possibilities other than what they were being told on the television. But that subsided, and people figured out that, you know, okay, well, we got sold this reality that appeared to be real, but you look at it further and it's not real at all. Well, that's going to get more sophisticated as the days go by, and it's going to be become much more difficult for you to discern and to decide what things are in operation, what are being launched against you, what are these things that we're seeing, and they are ratcheting it all up. And a lot of things that I've talked about and predicted here are coming true with this Ron Paul campaign. I mean, it's just been unbelievable to watch that. I mean, I told you like 3 or 4 or 5 months ago that we were probably going to see a Romney Paul ticket, and that's starting to look like that may be a reality. At least according to the information that was in this article that came out, I believe it came out yesterday from the Washington Post. For Romney and Paul, a strategic alliance between establishment and outsider. The remaining candidates in the windowed Republican presidential field are attacking one another with abandon each day, bringing fresh headlines of accusations and outrage. But Mitt Romney and Ron Paul haven't laid a hand on each other. They never do. Despite deep differences on a range of issues, Romney and Paul became friends in 2008, the last time both ran for president. So did their wives, Ann Romney and Carol Paul. The former Massachusetts governor compliments the Texas congressman during debates, praising Paul's religious faith during the last one in Jacksonville, Florida. Immediately afterward, as it is often the case, the Pauls and the Romneys gravitated towards one another to say hello. The Romney-Paul alliance is more than a curious connection. It is a strategic partnership. For Paul, an opportunity to gain a seat at the table if his long-shot bid for the presidency fails. For Romney, a chance to gain support from one of the most vibrant subgroups within the Republican Party. It would be very foolish for anybody in the Republican Party to dismiss a very real constituency, said one senior GOP aide in Washington who is familiar with both camps. Ron Paul plays a very valuable part in the process and brings a lot of voters towards the Republican Party and ultimately into the voting booth, and that's something that can't be ignored. That's an unbelievable statement right there. You read that? That guy just admitted to everything that my complete argument, everything I ever say about why you shouldn't vote at all. You hear that? Ron Paul plays a valuable part in the process, brings a lot of voters towards the Republican Party. Think about how many people they've got to switch over to the Republican that were Democrats. I've seen it, man. I used to be in 9/11 groups with these guys. They were hardcore card-carrying lefty pinko commie Democrats, man. And Ron Paul came along, and they got swept up in that Jones Brigade and with 9/11 Truth, and boom, man, they're switching over to Republicans. And ultimately into the voting booth, and that's something that can't be ignored. And that's the whole, right there, they just admitted the exact word-for-word reasoning behind Ron Paul. He plays a valuable part in the process because he brings in a lot of voters, but what they don't mention is he also takes votes away from other candidates, which ensure that Romney gets up there. That's what he's done all along. And boy, oh boy, oh boy, we may see what I said yet. Well, we I was joking around about that, really, the first time I said it. I really was just, you know, spitballing in the wind. I didn't really believe they would actually go forward with it, but goddamn it, it looks like they might. We may see it. We may very well see a Romney-Paul ticket, and we may very well see some crazy, tripped-out, MK-Ultra'd, Michael Aquino'd, you know, InfoWars, We Are Change t-shirt-wearing motherfucker cap Romney so they can have the almighty chosen one, the savior on the white steed, Ron Paul, in as president. I would not even be shocked by that at all. Would not be shocked by that at all. And you know, you look at it, you know, if you were on that team, that'd probably be the smart play, wouldn't it? Probably be a smart play. Yeah. Yeah. We'll just let Ron Paul in there, and then we'll send some crazy mind controlled lunatic in there from one of the CIA or the secret rights, World Vision. Yeah. We'll send somebody from World Vision, like that guy that tried to kill Reagan, so Poppy could get in there quicker as president. Fortunately, that didn't work. Or maybe one of those guys that trained with a guy that shot, Lenin. He was a World Vision too. Yeah. There was a guy a few years ago, back in 2007, I think it was, that shot up, I don't know if you guys heard about this, he shot up a big church, went on this tirade about right-wingers and Freemasons, went on a tirade and shot a bunch of people, and then, you know, conveniently killed himself afterwards. But his blogs and stuff were up. He had a bunch of blogs and postings on his board, and this was about 6 months before I had ever heard of the CMP. And he had a bunch of, this guy had a bunch of stuff on his websites and stuff about the CMP. Yeah, true story. And that guy supposedly went nuts and killed all these Christians and then killed himself. The whole thing at the time just totally smelled like a mind control op to me. And these, you know, that's what these guys do. So it would not surprise me in the least bit if we saw a Romney Paul ticket, wouldn't surprise me the least bit. And least bit number two, wouldn't surprise me if some crazy cracker nutter, mind controlled right winger went and, took care of Romney so they could have Paul in there as the savior. I mean, because, you know, you're going to put these crazy right wingers who are spoiling for a fight, you're going to put them in a precarious position, aren't you? Because, you know, normally we're accusing the government of something, but now people are accusing, you know, Ron Paul of having something to do with the assassination of Mitt Romney and blah, blah, blah. So I don't believe them. You see that kind of pickle that creates? Because they're going to believe, well, yeah, normally I wouldn't trust the government in this. I think the government was lying, and yeah, they probably did it, but, you know, like JFK or something. But in this point, I have to believe the government's telling the truth because, you know, Ron Paul's the president, and he wouldn't have anything to do with that. I mean, man, this is going to be interesting. And it is getting more interesting. I mean, with that article there from the Washington Post where, you know, it just lays it out and talks about how they're, you know, pretty much says these guys are going to be Running Maze together. And then, you got to love this because, you know, I've been saying from the beginning that these anonymous hacker guys were probably, government operators. But, you know, there's been a widely held sentiment in the truth movement, patriot movement, that these guys are, you know, fighting on the side against the New World Order and all this stuff. So I love this. This is just pure liquid gold. Anonymous exposed Nazi third position bridging tactic with Ron Paul. Now, the most interesting thing about this is not because, well, look, I mean, it's an obvious fact. I don't even know why they keep harping on this. If everybody would just, Ron Paul just needs to own up to this white supremacist stuff and just say, look, yeah, you know what? I did take money from these guys. They did, because anybody, you know, we could start the Eat Baby Brigade, right? Baby eaters for Ron Paul. We could start that group. And if we had enough money behind us and we're giving enough money to Ron Paul's PACs and to his campaign and everything else, it could be arranged for us to have a dinner meeting with Ron Paul, and it would be on the books. Baby eaters for Ron Paul, you know, give $500,000 donation to his PAC and meet with him for dinner. And it would be, you know, Ron Paul meets with baby eaters and associates with baby eaters. So it's already obvious that he has connections to these people. He just needs to own up to and say, yeah, you know, look. But that he can't do that. The reason he can't do that is because then he's going to expose the whole game. Because the game is these guys associate with whoever gives them money. Why do you think that he would go on Alex Jones' show and say, oh, yeah, I support a new investigation. Yeah, I think we do need a new investigation. I don't think we ever found out the truth about 9/11. Because he's talking to the constituency of people of that audience who he knows are going to be supporting. So he's, as a politician, he's saying what those people, what he believes those people want to hear. So they give him, but then when he's put in another position, he says, oh, no, I disavow those people. I don't want anything to do with that. And you know, these people get mad and pissed off about that. But, you know, that's you. What do you expect from a dog but fleas? You know what I mean? You put your faith in someone who is a politician, and then that kind of behavior happens, which always inherently happens with any politician, but then you get freaked out and wonder why that happens. He's a politician, man. His job is to be a politician. That's what he does. But what's interesting about this is that this new information that Anonymous has now released shows the connection of one of these, this guy Kelso, Jamie Kelso, who he was on the record meeting with and having meetings with as a campaign contributor. This guy supposedly is a former Scientologist. Now, we'll get back to that in a minute, folks, but those of you who have been looking at this information and listening to my show for quite a while will know there are some pretty deep and heavy connections with Scientology in the CMP and in the Secret Right and all the rest of this stuff. Reverend Sung Young Moon. The Nationalist American Third Party pursued a bridging tactic with the Ron Paul Revolution Movement that supported the Republican candidate for the White House, according to emails hacked by Anonymous, calling for a white uprising. That's what I'm telling you, man. That's what these guys see. This, that's what they think the Ron Paul Revolution is the white uprising to these people. That's what this is. That's what this whole thing is. And they're hiding it under the guise of, oh, for the Constitution. This is the white uprising. They are trying to create a fucking race war. I wish you goddamn idiots would wake up and see it. But no, they just want to sit around, oh, is Ron Paul a racist? Is he not? Yes. He is a figurehead for a much larger movement that's been brewing underground and using the 9/11 truth movement and the conspiracy movement as a front to bring itself to fruition. Now, I've seen through this 4 or 5 years ago. Saw this right when I got on air. And I've been up here screaming and yelling about this ever since. And slowly but surely, people are waking up to it. But I don't know why you can't see this now for what it is. The entire truth movement, patriot movement, conspiracy genre was hijacked. Right after 9/11, they killed Bill Cooper. And then they hijacked the entire conspiracy research genre. Installed Alex Jones as the front man of this new 9/11 truth movement, and then melded that and mushed that together with the decades of John Birch Society and militiamen, BS and white supremacist stuff. And they rolled it into one big ball. And anybody that had got caught up in that inadvertently started supporting causes and people of white supremacy that they didn't want to support just because they were coming looking for the truth. That's the facts. That's what happened. Other excerpts show Jamie Kelso's efforts in organizing meetings between Ron Paul and other members of A3P, such as corporate lawyer William D. Johnson, chairman of the neo-Nazi A3P. Johnson, who in 1985 proposed a constitutional amendment that would revoke the American citizenship of every non-white U.S. citizen, founded the American Third Position along with anti-Semite Kevin McDonald, professor at California State University, Long Beach. I'm going to the Conservative Political Action Conference with Bill Johnson, reads an email to A3P member dated January 2011. Bill and I will be meeting with Ron and Rand Paul. I have a teleconference with Bill and Ron Paul tonight, much more later. Things are starting to happen thanks to folks like you. So, you know, there you go. I mean, this is the second such account we have of somebody, but of course they'll just come and say, oh, well, that person who said that's a kook and nobody likes him anyway. I always have some way to try to roll out of this. They are brewing a race war in this country, and they're using the divide and conquer tactics of the old flag-waving hysteria. We learned nothing from the McCarthy era on. We learned nothing. We just rolled over right back into the same old goddamn stupid divided ways of thinking that they wanted us to. In another passage, Kelso, a former Scientologist, an account owner of other German Nazi forums, wrote, I'll be at CPAC from February 9th to February 12th. I'll send back reports to you from personal meetings with Ron Paul, newly elected Senator Rand Paul, and many others. I'll be here on White News Now, a place that is really starting to get interesting because of the presence of folks like you. Birds of a feather flock together, and we are really gathering some quality here. Kelso's strategy appears to be to connect with the extremist wings of the Ron Paul supporters to lobby A3P racist policies. Excuse me. So, I mean, let me read this for you. This is CMP and Scientology. It says, what is the CMP? It is a private network of self-appointed elitists who feel they have the right to speak for all Christians and make national policies. The first president of the CMP was Tim LaHaye, husband of Beverly LaHaye for Concerned Women of America. And it goes on to name a bunch of the people. Dateline aired an expose on Scientology on June 16th, 1998. How some people single-handedly take this organization on, spending their own millions to get a movement rolling to expose Scientology for what it is. The apathy they encounter is typical. The media cannot really point out the problems because they have an arrangement with these organizations to show both sides of the story, which gives it a neutral flavor, and nothing much came to light except that there's a small war going on. Scientologists use the good cause syndrome as bait to draw conservatives into their snare. However, their true motives have nothing to do with good causes. Hitler was a master of the bait-and-switch strategy, basing his plea for acceptance of National Socialism on a platform of conservative causes such as anti-communism and anti-homosexuality, patriotism, and morality. A similar development is occurring in the U.S., where conservatives who are alarmed at the moral decline of the nation are desperately aligning themselves with groups like the Church of Scientology and the Unification Church of the Reverend Sung Yung Moon, who promises to help them achieve the good cause they desire. A primary example of this are the connections between Scientologists and the Council for National Policy. The CMP is a highly secretive coalition of numerous evangelical ministries such as Focus on the Family, the Family Research Council, Christian Coalition, and Concerned Women for America. With Council on Foreign Relations members, entrepreneurs, legislators, former high-ranking military leaders, Mooney Front organizations, TV preachers, and the bulk of the multimillionaire Coors family and Catholics, belonging to cults such as Opus Dei, Dar, and the Knights of Malta. Scientology's appeal to Christian right groups has been through exposing psychiatry and psychology in the schools and the drugging of children with Ritalin, Prozac, etc. However, though they have succeeded in removing psychology from California schools, the Scientologists have replaced it with L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics. L. Ron Hubbard's CCHR webpage lists Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum, Gary Bauer's Family Research Council, the Rutherford Institute, Beverly LaHaye's Concerned Women of America, and CMP member Carol Steinke as signatories of the Scientology pledge promoting the removal of psychology from the schools. These high-profile evangelical ministries are then used as models by the Church of Scientology to encourage Christian parents to sign the Scientology pledge. Lest it seems that these evangelical ministries are naive about such cults, Beverly LaHaye and Gary Bauer were featured speakers to the tune of $80,000 to $150,000 each at Moon Families Federation for World Peace and the Unification Conference in 1996. And Bauer purchases full-page ads in Moon's Washington Times. A transcript of Moon's blasphemous speech at this conference, in which he states, unchallenged by the attendees, that Jesus Christ failed in his mission, is available on his website. These guys have been knee-deep with Scientology for years. People have accused Alan Jones of being a Scientologist. I've heard that. I haven't really seen the evidence or the proof of that. I don't really know where that comes from, but to me it is interesting to the fact that, again, here's this guy. We see a definite connection. It seems that we're starting to see connections to white supremacy and these white nationalist groups with Scientology, which, of course, I mean, look at the roots of Scientology, folks. I mean, it's full-blown Babylon mystery school stuff that, put it to you like this, L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons is one of the greatest rocket scientists that ever lived, okay? He's also one of the greatest occultists and magicians that ever lived. He brought the OTO to the Ordo Templi Orientis. He brought that to the United States. We set it up in Pasadena, California, the same place where they set up Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And these guys were both disciples of Crowley, and L. Ron Hubbard basically took the things, the teachings from the mystery schools, the teachings of the Anunnaki and these ancient stories of, you know, ancient extraterrestrials and all this stuff, and created Scientology out of it. And so it makes complete sense to me that you would see Scientology coming from sort of this, you know, information that the priest class have been hiding from us, originating back to the Babylonian mystery religions that were, of course, you know, derived directly from the Anunnaki when they were living here on Earth at that time. And that's the time when the priests had direct contact with the quote-unquote gods, and so that's when they were transferring the information back and forth. Well, that's what these mystery religions taught. And those are the things that the, you know, like the Thule Society and the Golden Dawn, OTO, and then later, you know, Crowley got into all this stuff. That's all this stuff is derivative of that. So when you really look at Scientology, it really fits the bill perfectly for the one world religion. So when you see these priest class minions and bozos, these CMP types like Phyllis Schlafly, Gary Bauer, and Beverly LaHaye working hand in hand with L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology to get creationism taken out and put in Scientology, and then all of a sudden we have a connection with someone who used to be allegedly a Scientologist and is having dinner meetings with Ron Paul, who's a white supremacist, you see where this interwoven narrative of the priest class and the Vatican having their hands in all these pies, especially the white supremacy stuff, you see where this really comes into full fruition. It's just unbelievable to me that people can still ignore all this information when it's been out here for years. I've been screaming and yelling about it for 5 years now. And frankly, I'm getting my wits in about it. Frankly, I'm just getting where, you know, I'm going to still get up here and expose this stuff. But, you know, my care of the outcome is starting to wane. I really get tired of saying, yeah, see, I told you so. Yeah, see? Really get tired of that. Let's see what else we have. Oh, here's a great story for you. So, the other night, it was the first, so I guess that would have been Wednesday night. Yeah, Wednesday night. I was about to go into local grocery store here. And I was about to go in the store, and right as I looked up, and I just saw this big, gigantic, it looked just like, you guys ever see Star Trek III, the Search for Spock? Okay, you remember when they tricked the Klingons into boarding their ship, and they beam themselves down to Genesis, and they hit the self-destruct on the Enterprise, and it blows up, and it fucking comes down on the planet, and you see it trailing across the sky, burning up in the atmosphere? That's what I saw. That's exactly what it looked like. Red, glowing, it looked like the fucking Enterprise. It didn't move like any meteor or anything I'd ever seen. And it was crackling, and it was moving slow across the sky. Me and like five or six other people in the parking lot of this grocery store all witnessed this. People were freaking out. This one lady goes, I think that was a firework. I'm like, ma'am, what is today? February 1st. What are we celebrating on February 1st? That was not a firecracker, a firework. I mean, it literally looked like something was burning up or had been blown up on reentry. It was insane. And come to find out, the fireball in Texas sky was a meteor, says the FAA. WFAA in Dallas received more than 200 reports Wednesday night from people who said that they saw what appeared to be a meteor streaking across the North Texas sky shortly after 8 o'clock. Many people also said they heard what sounded like a sonic boom. Yeah, it happened at my parents' house. They shook the walls, and we didn't hear that here. I was kind of farther away. I heard the crackling. But a lot of people said it was a sonic boom sounding thing. And I don't know, man. I've seen a lot of meteors. This thing did not look like a meteor to me. It was huge. It, to me, I think it was a craft or something they shot down. It was entering our atmosphere and it was burning up on its way in. That's what I think it was. If it was a meteor, I'll kiss your ass. And they had that motherfucker story up. It was like 20 minutes after I saw it. Boom. They already had it was a meteor, up instantly. But listen to this, very bright blue across the sky in Benbrook. So that person said blue. What we saw where I was at was totally 100% red. Bright fucking red. Now this person says it was blue. Now listen to this. We saw it in Far West McKinney. Seemed very low. Thought it was a low-flying plane. Of course, it may have been very high and very large. It was gold with a trail of sparkling, dripping fire. So that person said it was blue. This person said it was gold. I was on the other end of the Metroplex and it looked red. Does that sound like a normal meteor type thing to you? Wasn't moving as fast as most meteors I've seen. So that's a person said the same thing I did. It moved from east to west and then seemed to burn out shortly after that. We heard a double boom. It reminded me of the sonic booms we heard as kids in the 60s. It was pretty incredible. It was a double boom, something hit it, then there was another boom. I heard a light boom, and then my house lightly shook. Dawn Cadell De La Rosa was sitting out on her porch about 15 miles west of Denton. It was huge, very low, she wrote. It came from the southwest. Went in front of our house. Both my husband and I yelled, oh my God, it's going to hit that plane. It looked like it got east of Denton when it broke apart and exploded. We could see all the little embers blasting southeastward. Those poor people in the plane, I bet they thought it was the end of their life. We were driving on Highway 380 in Bridgeport and thought it was a helicopter flying low until it started glowing orange. So let me get this straight. So blue, gold, and orange, and I saw red. So that's kind of unbelievable. And, I got to say, man, I saw this thing instantly, and I thought, I couldn't, but first off, I was in shock normally I don't get lucky enough to see something like that. And I just looked up at the right time, and right about the time I heard a bunch of people in the parking lot, it was bizarre. It's like something out of a movie screaming, oh my God, did you see that? Did you see that? Oh my God. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, I saw. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was like I was meant to be there at that moment to see that thing streak across the sky to verify to you that, look, folks, you know me, man. That was not a meteor. It was moving way too slow. It was almost like something was entering our atmosphere that didn't know that it would burn up if it came into our atmosphere, I don't know what it was, but I really don't think it was a meteor. That's my honest opinion. It could be, yeah, it could be. I mean, it's probably due to the fact, I mean, didn't we have some kind of big asteroid coming near Earth this week, like 19 miles near Earth? It could be that. But also it could be, well, look, I've talked a bit about, you know, pole shifts and stuff like that. Here's the thing is, the misconception, people say that we're going through a pole shift, but the actual indicators seem to be that our sun is actually going through a pole shift, which happens periodically. It doesn't really cause, you know, destruction and stuff like that per se. It's just part of the thing that happens because, you know, it's electromagnetic energy. So the pole shift occasionally, well, what generally happens when you have a star like our sun having a pole shift is that, well, the poles are reversing, so the magnetic field is reversing, right? So comets that are made of, you know, dense metals and or asteroids or whatever else are being drawn into this thing, but as the poles are shifting, it's just flinging these things right back. So our sun is just ejecting meteors and comets and all this stuff out of itself right now, and I think that's what a lot of this stuff that we're seeing, because I mean, I've been seeing this kind of stuff for the past 5 or 6 years. Sometimes I see these big green trails, these big things that streak across the sky, almost like a sperm or a protozoa, a big, long, green thing with a tail like a, I mean, I don't know what that is, you know? There is some really, really insane, crazy stuff. Let's see what else we have here tonight. Oh, I had an email I wanted to read here. I left this one off earlier. It says, good morning, Josh. I would like to say thank you for what you have done and will do. I, like many of your new listeners, got the first taste of your unique brand of hosting when I listened to your reading of the 12th Planet. Well, actually, that was Lost Book of Enki. I didn't read the 12th Planet. But I have a few things I would love to bring up to you. Number one, I think that Inner Earth Emerald Bird is real, and they are an older race or form of humans. Like in a time machine, there's a scene where underground humans has the hot chick for breeding going on, and the Anunnaki was aware of the fact that they were on Earth, but thought they died out. That was the reason they did not go to Earth in the first place. Yeah, it could be. I think the rock wall is a part of a much larger history, and there were water pyramids and underground networks between Cuba and the Bahamas and throughout the whole Caribbean. Maybe you should hit the beach and check them out. And the U.S. has a reach base in the Bahamas, which is known, but I cannot find anything online about it. Thank you once again, and keep up the good work. All right. Thank you, Renio. Yeah, I've been looking at some of this stuff more and more with the inner earth stuff. And, it makes me wonder if these people that set themselves up as gods didn't actually come from within the earth and concocted this whole story that they came from, you know, space and Nibiru and all this stuff, because they were very advanced technologically, but they came up to, I don't know. There's, well, look, let me give you an example of this. This story came out a couple of weeks ago, and this is highly interesting, especially with the things of bloodlines and the origins of a species. One of the places where they say one of these inner earth entrances is supposedly in the Altai Mountains, which is near Russia. It's in southern Siberia, but supposedly this is where, you know, this race of giants, the Ascended Masters, this is where they exist. And this article came out on January 26th. Native Americans actually came from a tiny mountain region in Siberia. DNA research reveals tiny regions in central Russia has DNA linked to Native Americans today. So those Native Americans came where they originated from, was the area, the people that came across the land bridge and came and inhabited North America and all this stuff. they traced back their DNA to its farthest point, and the farthest point where it came back from just happens to be Altai, right at the entrance of Inner Earth. So I'm starting to think more and more that that yes, these extraterrestrials don't come from outer space or from out there somewhere, but actually from another world which exists simultaneously with ours inside of the Earth. And I think that Admiral Byrd's testimony is very telling, and that combined with the fact that this footage was shown in some movie theaters for some time, and people had seen it and then later taken and edited and the rest of it. But the things that these inhabitants supposedly said to Admiral Byrd from his testimony are very interesting. It says, I bid you welcome to our domain, Admiral. He's saying this to Admiral Byrd. This is his testimony. I see a man with delicate features and with the etching of years upon his face. He is seated at a long table. He motions me to sit down in one of the chairs. After I'm seated, he places his fingertips together and smiles. He speaks softly again and conveys the following. We have let you enter here because you are of noble character and well-known on the surface world, Admiral. Surface world? I half gasp under my breath. Yes, the master replies with a smile. You are in the domain of the Ariani, the inner world of the Earth. We shall not long delay your mission, and you will be safely escorted back to the surface and for a distance beyond. But now, Admiral, I shall tell you why you have been summoned here. Our interest rightly begins just after your race exploded the first atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was at that alarming time we sent our flying machines, the Fugelrods, to your surface world to investigate what your race had done. Now, that's a fact. We had Roswell right after that. It's really when we started to see flying machines right after the advent of the atomic bomb. It's kind of hard to deny that. That is, of course, past history now, my dear Admiral, but I must continue on. You see, we have never interfered before in your race's wars and barbarity, but now we must. For you have learned to tamper with a certain power that is not for man, namely that of atomic energy. Our emissaries have already delivered messages to the powers of your world, and yet they do not heed. Now you have been chosen to be witness here that our world does exist. You see, our culture and science is many thousands of years beyond your race, Admiral. I interrupted, but what does this have to do with me, sir? The master's eyes seemed to penetrate deeply into my mind, and after studying me for a few moments, he replied, "Your race has now reached the point of no return. For there are those among you who would destroy your very world rather than relinquish their power as they know it." That about fit up, sum up and fit the New World Order for you? That's exactly the case. All of my research shows me that's exactly. They would rather destroy this planet than give up the power they have over it. I nodded and the master continued. In 1945 and afterward, we tried to contact your race, but our efforts were met with hostility. Our Flugelrods were fired upon, yes, even pursued with malice and animosity by your fighter planes. So now I say to you, my son, there is a great storm gathering in your world, a black fury that will not spend itself for many years. There will be no answer in your armies. There will be no safety in your science. It may rage on until every flower of your culture is trampled and all human things are leveled in vast chaos. Your recent war was only a prelude of what is yet to come for your race. We here see it more clearly with each hour. Do you say I am mistaken? No, I answer. It happened once before. The Dark Ages came, and they lasted for more than 500 years. Yes, my son, replied the master. The Dark Ages that will come now for your race will cover the earth like a pall. But I believe that some of your race will live through the storm. Beyond that, I cannot say. We see at a great distance a new world stirring from the ruins of your race, seeking its lost and legendary treasures. and they will be here, my son, safe in our keeping. When that time arrives, we shall come forward again to help revive your culture and your race. Perhaps by then you will have learned the futility of war and its strife. And after that time, certain of your culture and science will be returned for your race to begin anew. You, my son, are to return to the surface world with this message. With those closing words, our meeting seemed at an end. I stood for a moment as in a dream, but yet I knew this was reality. And for some strange reason, I bowed slightly, either out of respect or humility, I don't know which. Suddenly, I was again aware that the two beautiful hosts who had brought me here were again at my side. "This way, Admiral," motioned one. I turned once more before leaving and looked back toward the master. A gentle smile was etched on his delicate ancient face. "Farewell, my son," he spoke. Then he gestured with a lovely slender hand motion of peace, and our meeting was truly ended. This guy sounds like fucking Lando Calrissian or something, doesn't he? Sounds like he's running the Cloud City, you know, running a bootlegging operation. "Take care, my son. Let Lando put some bitches on you and some Gold 45. Here we go." Quickly, he walked back through the great door of the master's chamber and once again entered into the elevator. The door slid silently downward, and we were once again going upward. One of my hosts spoke again. "We must now make haste, Admiral, as the master desires to delay you no longer on your scheduled timetable, and you must return with his message to your race." And that was taken from A Flight to the Land Beyond the North Pole, The Missing Diary of Admiral E. Byrd. I'm starting to think that these watchers were, you know, have been watching from inside of the earth and still are and have been. These are the watchers that have been talked about. You know, and yet we've been told that, these are extraterrestrials. I think the powers that be full know. Of course they do, of this inner world. They've done their best to close off entrances to it. I know Mammoth Cave in Kentucky is supposedly a big one. They 34 years ago, you could get down in these entrances, but I think some people got in there and didn't come back out. So they've closed off a lot of the entrances. You got to ask yourself why that is, you know, if there's nothing to it. Have you actually ever seen actual photos of the poles of the earth? I'm not talking about something you see on a map. Go find yourself an actual picture, like actual pole pictures. There are big holes that go into the earth on both sides of our poles. They never show those in maps or on globes or anything, but they're there. So I'm starting to see more and more evidence, folks, that, you know, we've been looking out there somewhere for these extraterrestrials, and we should have been looking inside here somewhere. We are going to take a break, come back, finish up with a few more news stories, and then get into The End of Days by Zachariah Sitchin for you here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And we thank you so much for being with us. Please support our work if you can. We did not reach our goal last month for our 2012 kickoff, and we barely got the bills paid, so we don't have a lot left in the kitty now, and we're going to have some help here. So please help us out if you can. Keeps us commercial free, uncensored, no ads, and unfiltered information. So please go and make a donation if you can help us out, because we really need your support right now. We'll take a break, come back, and get into more for you here tonight. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
Uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the show. Late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast for you here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, and glad you could be here with us for another live edition. And we had some technical issues, so that's why we're starting later tonight. But a lot of people, I wasn't actually going to do a Friday night show anymore because, we weren't doing them for a while, and then I started doing them again. But then on Friday nights, it'd be like nobody tuned in, nobody in the chat room, nobody listened. So I started getting the impression nobody give a fuck about a show on a Friday night. So, but we didn't have one the past couple of nights. So, hey, we're here, and I'll continue to do shows on Friday night if people want to listen. But if they don't, I'm not going to get up here and deflate my jaws if nobody's going to be tuned in. You know what I mean? I hate to be like that, but if I look on the stream and there's just, there's not really many people on there. It's just the want for me to get up here and do it is not really not there. So, there you go. See, I think I've had a few more news stories I wanted to hit, and then we'll get into end of days tonight. Since there's a small amount of radiation has escaped from a Southern California nuclear plant, and there's a massive cover-up going on there. You guys see these nanocopter swarms? It's pretty rad. Till they put fucking guns on them and they fly them into your house and, be warding off nano drones all the time. This is a fascinating story to me. Dung beetles' quick step may inspire future robots. I shit you not, the dung beetle, of course, like the scarab beetle, hugely revered in Egypt. They had these glass, yellow glass scarabs, carved out that look like, they're totally laser edge. There's no way they could have done it with anything but a laser. And, you saw this as a very powerful symbol on the wing disc with a scarab beetle on it. And, people have long had translations and stuff for that, but now, it seems to me, like in some of the movies, like the Mummy movies and stuff, some of the, you always had these scarab beetles that look like machines. And a lot of the stuff in the artwork, in Egyptian artwork, looks like machines, especially stuff in the Temple of Hathor, Dendera. There's a lot of stuff there that looks like machines. Well, it seems now that scientists are now studying these dung beetles, scarab beetles, and they're going to be creating AI autonomous robots based on the movements for these scarabs. So, come on. Are we supposed to really, as a researcher, am I supposed to really think or not think more appropriately that, this is based on or mimicking some ancient technology, probably Anunnaki stuff that, there's a reason. Come on, Ankh. The word Ankh is very close to Anunnaki. But perhaps, the movies are right. Perhaps they did have these robots and these things that were, and that's why these were so revered, is because they could build these, autonomous robots that look like scary. It's fascinating. The dance of the dung beetle has long amused insect watchers. Now scientists say that the way insects move could inspire the design of future robots. Emily Baird, a researcher from Lund University in Sweden, said the beetles use their circular strut as a corrective navigation system when moving dung balls away from the pile. For us, it seems the beetles are using this dance to cope with situations when they've been disturbed. So they want to roll in a straight line when they can no longer do that. When they fall in a hole, this dance allows them to get their bearings again so they can keep rolling in a straight line. Such efficient navigation allows the beetle to scuttle away as quickly as possible from its competitors. The research was sponsored by the U.S. Air Force Office of Scientific Research, which believes it may have much to learn from the humble bug. Right. Well, this, what this tells me? That tells me they already have these things, and they're rolling this out as this, publicly funded research so they can roll out this technology they already have and have a backstory and a cover story from where it originated from. that's what they've been looking for, these ancient antiquities folks. That's what they want. They want the keys to this technology. So yeah, that's a very fascinating story right there. Oh yeah, the journey, yeah, you use the scarab beetle all over it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Journey, Escape. And it's funny, too, because before, well, for the first like three Journey albums, they didn't even have a singer. It was just all instrumental stuff. And then somebody at the record label started pushing the Steve Perry on them. And they didn't have any hits, and the record company wanted some hits. All of a sudden, boom, they get Steve Perry in the band. The first album they have with Steve Perry on has a Scarab Beetle on it, and boom, they have number one hits. Not a coincidence. I'm not for a second. Steve Perry's got to be a bloodline or something like that. Otherwise, you know, because it just seemed, I mean, I've seen interviews with Neil Sean and stuff from Journey where he said, literally, they forced him on us. We didn't even want him in the band. He was not our choice. They said, either you take on his guy as a singer and start producing hits. We've given you three albums. You haven't given us any hits. So you've just made instrumental stuff. You take this guy and you in your band and you make hits, or we're dropping you from the label. Your choice. So they said, okay, well, if they're going to, you know, our music career ends here, or we make a record with this guy, well, we might as well make a record with this guy and see what happens. Boom, Scarab Beetle on the cover. Boom, number one hits. The rest is history. Yeah. Not a coincidence at all. Remember how in the movie The Matrix humans were used as energy sources by the machines? I personally thought the idea was inefficient. Why not make batteries or something? But still, it appears that we are now the machines and have been able to rig a poor cockroach up with electrodes and squeeze out some measurable amount of electricity. Maximum power density reached near 100 microwatts per square centimeter at 0.2 volts. Maximum current density was about 450 microamps per square centimeter. It's the chemical within each roach that power this particular reaction, and if you want the gritty details of how it was done, just hit the jump for a fuller description and links. The key to converting the chemical energy is using enzymes in a series at the anode. The first enzyme breaks the sugar trehalose, which a cockroach constantly produces from its food, into two simple sugars called monosaccharides. The second enzyme oxidizes the monosaccharides, releasing electrons. The current flows as electrons are drawn to the cathode, where oxygen from air takes up the electrons and is reduced to water. After testing the system using trehalose solutions, prototype electrodes were installed in a blood sinus in the abdomen of a female cockroach, away from the critical internal organs. Insects have an open circulatory system, so the blood is not under much pressure. So unlike, say, a vertebrae, where if you pushed a probe into a vein or worse, an artery, which is very high blood pressure, blood does not come out at any pressure. So basically, this is really pretty benign. So they're, biochemical, etherical energy. And, that's here now. They've learned how to tap into that. I mean, they're already creating suits for the army that power these super suits for super soldiers, you know, basically making them super soldiers. They're powered off of bioelectrical energy. See, all these stories are now revolving around things that are here. They're, you know, they try to still kind of coax us into it and make us not, you know, get too scared too fast of what's coming. But fact of the matter, this stuff's here. This is interesting. It's got everybody buzzing, you know, wondering if this is some kind of sort of, they came in contact with some sort of extraterrestrial force or what's going on with this, considering, or maybe they went into inner Earth, who knows. Riddle of the Russian scientists drilling into alien Antarctic lake buried under ice for 20 million years, who have been out of radio contact for 5 days. So, yeah, these guys are going in, you know, right near the poles, near entrances to inner Earth, and now they've been out of radio contact for 5 days. 20-million-year-old lake. A team of Russian scientists has mysteriously lost contact with colleagues in the U.S. as they drill into a lake buried beneath the Antarctic ice for 20 million years. The scientists have been battling conditions of minus 66 degrees Celsius at Lake Vostok as they raced to drill into a lake buried 2 miles beneath the ice before the weather closed in. The scientists hope that the lake's untouched water will reveal more about life on our planet 20 million years ago. The lake in the most inhospitable region of the planet is kept liquid by geothermal heat under the ice, and its conditions are often described as alien because they are thought to be akin to the subterranean lakes on Jupiter's moon Europa. Their radio silence has conjured chilling echoes of classic horror films, The Thing, where scientists dig up a buried spacecraft in the Antarctic ice only to unleash an extraterrestrial horror within. Yeah, X-Files, too. You gotta entertain that for a minute, don't you? I mean, shit. There's just been too much real stuff in movies that has come to fruition or TV shows, you know, to ignore something like that. Valery Lukin, chief of the Russian Antarctic expedition, said last month, "We do not know what is waiting for us down there. The water inside the lake will have had no contact with man-made pollutants or earthly life forms for millions of years." Last year, the scientists working in the freezing temperatures at Lake Vostok came within 10 to 50 meters of the surface of the relic lake. With the summer almost over, the team have to leave the remote site within days before it gets too cold for a plane to land. So they don't know what happened to these guys. They probably fell into fucking inner earth, and they're like, "Fuck this, we're never going back. Fuck them. Inner earth is awesome. We're never going back. Fuck it." Oh, they're ratcheting up the Iran fear-mongering. I don't even gonna get into that. Bunch of horse shit. Oh, man. All right, let's see if we can get into some end of days here. Tonight, give me just 1 second to bring it up. Okay. Picking up where we left off last time in Zachariah Sitchin's End of Days. The first recorded administrative ruler in the devastated South was an ex-governor of Mari, a city way northwest on the Euphrates River. We learn that he was not of Sumerian seed. His name, Ishibi Era, was in fact a Semitic name. He established his headquarters in the city of Isin, and from there he oversaw the efforts to resurrect the other major cities, but the process was slow, difficult, and at times chaotic. His efforts at rehabilitation were continued by several successors, also bearing Semitic names, the so-called Dynasty of Isin. Altogether, it took them close to a century to revive Ur, Sumer's economic center, and ultimately Nippur, the land's traditional religious heart. But by then, that city, at a time process, ran into challenges from other local city rulers, and the erstwhile Sumer remained fragmented in a broken land. Even Babylon itself, though outside the evil wind's direct path, needed a revived and repopulated country if it was to rise to the imperial size and status. And it did not attain the grandeur of Marduk's prophecies for quite some time. More than a century had to pass until a former dynasty, called by scholars the First Dynasty of Babylon, was installed on its throne circa 1900 BCE. Yet another century had to pass until a king who lived up to the prophesied greatness sat on Babylon's throne. His name was Hammurabi. He is mostly known for the code of laws proclaimed by him. Laws recorded on a stone stela that archaeologists have discovered and is now in the Louvre in Paris. It still took some two centuries before Marduk's prophetic vision regarding Babylon could come true. The meager evidence from the post-calamity time, some scholars refer to the period following the demise of Ur as a dark age in Mesopotamian history, suggests that Marduk let the other gods, even his adversaries, take care of the recovery and repopulation of their own olden cult centers. But it is doubtful that they took up his invitation. The recovery and rebuilding that were started by Ishibi Era began at Ur, but there is no mention of Nanar Sin and Ningal returning to Ur. There is mention of Ninurta's occasional presence in Sumer, especially in regard to its garrisoning by troops from Elam and Gutium. But there is no record that he or his spouse Bao ever returned to their beloved Lagash. The efforts by Ishibi Era and his successors to restore the cult centers and their temples culminated after the passage of 72 years at Nippur, but there is no mention that Enlil and Ninlil resumed residence there. Where had they gone? One avenue of exploring that intriguing subject was to ascertain what Marduk himself, now supreme and claiming to be the giver of commands to all the Anunnaki, had planned for them. Well, we talked about that last time. Where they went was, that's why they built these temples and these things directed towards certain different alignments. We see some towards Sirius. We see some towards Canis Major. We see some towards Cygnus and the Cygnus system. So, you know, that's kind of been one of the things for me is that, yes, we do see a lot of things all over the planet lined up to different locations, but some of them were located to different ones. And I think that's what this trick was, that of these gods. They were using a stargate to jump back and forth. And that other, when they would point their temples towards this other location, what they were pointing to was the jump point. And that represented one location where the Stargate was on Earth, and then the other location where the Stargate was on this somewhere else. And they made their followers believe that you know, that was where they were the lords over. That's why you had Allah being the Lord of Sirius. This guy came through a Stargate and set himself up as a god on Earth. The textual and other evidence from that time show that Marduk's rise to supremacy did not end polytheism, the religious belief in many gods. On the contrary, his supremacy required continued polytheism, for to be supreme over other gods, the existence of other gods was necessary. That's why, you know, put no other gods before me and all that stuff in the Bible. You know, well, what other gods? that was everybody's immediate question. I mean, it was mine. Who are these other gods that you don't want me to put before you? And what do they have to offer, good or bad, if you require my undying servitude and my, you know, you're going to give me your protection if so long as I don't worship these other gods? Well, can we have an interview process here, please? I'd like to interview these other gods individually, including yourself here, Mr. Christ. We'd just like to do this all formal and nice here, make sure we get all the particulars taken care of. I'd just like to interview each one of these gods individually, find out what each one has to offer. What kind of package are we offering? You know, sell yourself. Really, really get into it. You know, if you my undying servitude and worship, that doesn't come easy or cheap. And I'm a pretty picky bastard. I require some perks, you know. So let's get in here and talk about these other gods first before you start telling me you want me to disavow them, because I might be missing out on a good deal here. You know, these other gods may, you know, may be providing a lot more than what we're getting out of Eddie. You see what I mean here? Best man wins. Let's be democratic about this. And we'll line up these gods one by one, bring them in here and give them a little test. And you never know. I may decide I want to put this god over here above you. Doesn't make you less of a person. You're going to be able to go out and find a lot of other people who are going to worship you and join your cult, and it'll be all good. You know, don't take offense at me just because I feel this god over here has a little more to offer. You know, you weren't even allowing these other gods to even speak their case. You know, we had to go and find those. I mean, but don't you think, you know, I mean, put no other gods before me. Well, okay, let's see. We haven't even had a chance to see what these other gods have to offer yet before we make that promise. That's a little unfair. He was satisfied to let them be as long as their prerogatives were subject to his control. A Babylonian tablet recorded in its undamaged portion the following list of divine attributes that were henceforth vested in Marduk. Ninurta is Marduk of the hoe. Nergal is Marduk of the attack. Zababa is Marduk of the combat. Enlil is Marduk of lordship and counsel. Sin is Marduk, the illuminator of the night. Shamash is Marduk of justice. Adad is Marduk of reigns. The other gods remained, their attributes remained, but they now held attributes of Marduk that he granted to them. He let their worship be continued. The very name of the interim ruler, administrator in the south, Ishibi Era, priest of Era, i.e. of Nergal, confirms this tolerant policy. But what Marduk expected was that they come and stay with him in his envisaged Babylon, prisoners in golden cages, one may say. In his autobiographical prophecies, Marduk clearly indicated his intentions in regard to the other gods, including his adversaries. They were to come and reside next to him in Babylon's sacred precincts, sanctuaries or pavilions for Sin and Ningal, where they would reside together with their treasures and possessions, are specifically mentioned. texts describing Babylon and archaeological excavations there show that in accordance with Marduk's wishes, Babylon's sacred precinct also included resident shrines dedicated to Ninmah, Adad, Shamas, and even Ninurta. When Babylon finally rose to imperial power under Hammurabi, its ziggurat temple indeed reached skyward. The prophesied great king in time did sit on its throne, but to its priest-filled sacred precinct, the other gods did not flock. That manifestation of the new religion did not come about. Looking at the Hammurabi stela recording his law code, we see him receiving the laws from none other than Utu, Shamash, the very one, according to the above quoted list, whose prerogatives as god of justice now belong to Marduk. And the preamble inscribed on the stela invoked Anu and Enlil, the one whose lordship and counsel were presumably taken over by Marduk, as the gods to whom Marduk was beholden for his status. Lofty Anu, lord of the gods who from heaven to earth came, and Enlil, lord of heaven and earth who determines the land destinies, determined for Marduk, the firstborn of Enki, the Enlil functions over all mankind. These acknowledgments of the continued empowerment of Enlilite gods, 2 centuries after the age of Marduk began, reflect the actual state of affairs. They did not come to retire in Marduk's sacred precinct. Dispersed away from Sumer, some accompanied their followers to faraway lands in the four corners of the earth. Others remained nearby, rallying their followers, old and new, to a renewed challenge to Marduk. The sense that Sumer as a homeland was no more is clearly expressed in the divine instructions to Abram of Nippur on the eve of the nuclear upheavaling to Semitize his name to Abraham, and that of his wife Sarai to Sarah, and to make his permanent home in Canaan. Abraham and his wife were not the only Sumerians in need of a new refuge. The nuclear calamity triggered migrational movements on a scale unknown before. The first wave of people was away from the affected lands, its most significant aspect, and one with the most lasting effects was the dispersal of Sumer's remnants away from Sumer. The next wave of migrants was into that abandoned land, coming into waves from all directions. Whichever direction those migration waves took, the fruits of 2,000 years of Sumerian civilization were adopted by the other peoples that followed them in the next 2 millennia. Indeed, though Sumer as a physical entity was crushed, the attainments of its civilization are still with us to this day. Just look up your 12-month calendar. Check the time on your watch. That retained the Sumerian sexagesimal base 60 system, or drive in your contraption on wheels, a car. The evidence for a widespread Sumerian diaspora with its language, writing symbols, customs, celestial knowledge, beliefs, and gods comes in many forms. Beside the generalities, a religion based on a pantheon of gods who have come from the heavens, a divine hierarchy, god epithet names that mean the same in different languages, astrological knowledge that included a home planet of the gods, a zodiac with its 12 houses, virtually identical creation tales, and memories of gods and demigods that scholars treat as myths. There are a host of astounding specific similarities that cannot be explained other than by an actual presence of Sumerians. It was expressed in the spread in Europe of Ninurta's double eagle symbol. Oh, see, there we go. The double eagle symbol of Ninurta, which we saw taken over in England in Freemasonry. Yeah, see? The fact that 3 European languages, Hungarian, Finnish, and Basque, are akin only to Sumerian, and the widespread depiction throughout the world, even in South America, of Gilgamesh fighting off with bare hands 2 ferocious lions. In the Far East, there is the clear similarity between the Sumerian cuneiform writing and the scripts of China, Korea, and Japan. The similarity is not only in the script, many similar glyphs are identically pronounced and also have the same meanings. In Japan, civilization has been attributed to an enigmatic forefather tribe called Ainu. The emperor's family has been deemed to be a line of demigods, descended from the sun god, and the investiture ceremonies of a new king include a secret, solitary, nightly stay with the sun goddess, a ritual ceremony that uncannily emulates the sacred marriage rites in ancient Sumer when the new king spent a night with Inanna or Ishtar. In the erstwhile four regions, the migratory waves of diverse peoples triggered by the nuclear calamity and Marduk's new age, much like flowing and overflowing rivers and rivulets after stormy rains, filled the pages of the ensuing centuries with the rise and fall of nations, states, and city-states. Into the Sumerian void, newcomers came in from near and far. Their arena, their central stage, remained what can rightly be called the lands of the Bible. Indeed, until the advent of modern archaeology, little or nothing was known about most of them except for their mention in the Hebrew Bible. It provided not only a record of those various peoples, but also of their national gods and of the wars fought in the names of those gods. But then nations such as the Hittites, states such as the Mitanni, or royal capitals such as Mari, Carchemish, or Susa, which were doubt-filled puzzles, were literally dug up by archaeology. In their ruins, there were found not only telltale artifacts, but also thousands of inscribed clay tablets that brought to light both the existence as well as the extent of their debt to the Sumerian legacy. Virtually everywhere, Sumerian firsts in science and technologies, literature and art, kingship and priesthood were the foundation on which subsequent cultures were developed. In astronomy, Sumerian terminology, orbital formulas, planetary lists, and zodiacal concepts were retained. The Sumerian cuneiform script was kept in use for another 1,000 years, and then more. The Sumerian language was studied, Sumerian lexicons were compiled, and Sumerian epic tales of gods and heroes were copied and translated. And once those nations' diverse languages were deciphered, it turned out that their gods were, after all, members of the old Anunnaki pantheon. Did the Enlilite gods themselves accompany their followers when such replanting of Sumerian knowledge and belief took place in faraway lands? The data are inconclusive, but what is historically certain is that within 2 or 3 centuries of the New Age, in lands bordering Babylonia, those who were supposed to become Marduk's retired guests embarked on an even newer kind of religious affiliations, national state religions. Marduk may have garnered the 50 divine names, but did not prevent from then on nation fighting nation and men killing men in the name of their god, or in the name of God in general. And so that leaves off, that's the end of chapter 7, chapter 8, in the name of God, will be our next chapter. I'm sure that'll get into what we already know, you know, wars being fought in the name of these, in the name of God, in the name of, you know, this religion or that religion, and really it's just, well, these Anunnaki using it as chess pieces in their, you know, little game. But we'll get more into that next time. Thanks so much for being here with us tonight. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's TheGlobalReality.com. Go there and get a Blu-ray and a DVD of The Secret Volume 2. And please support our work if we can. We didn't reach our budget goal for the new film last month, and we don't have a lot left over to pay the bills. Shipping banner is there. Donate button is there. PO box is there. If you can't use PayPal, help us out if you can. My name's Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. You guys have a great weekend. Take care.